الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، ولعن الله الدائم على أعدائهم أجمعين من يومنا هذا إلى قيام يوم الدين. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. Respected elders and brothers and sisters, we've gathered here for a majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. One of the things that I've been trying to do over the course of the last few evenings is to emphasize the importance of these gatherings. They need to occupy a sacred place in our hearts and the hearts of our young ones and our children. One of the ways that we can understand their importance is by looking at the emphasis that the Imams alayhim assalam put on such gatherings. And one of those traditions we have is narrated from the time of our beloved sixth Imam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. The narration says that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam met somebody named Ja'far ibn Affan al-Ta'i. And he tells him that it has reached me, news has come to me, that you compose poetry for Al-Husayn alayhi salam, and that you do a good job when you do that poetry. And the poet, he acknowledges this. So Imam Sadiq alayhi salam asks him to recite some poetry, and it seems that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam had gathered his household and they were going to listen to this poet by the name of Ja'far, his poetry. When he began to recite, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam began to weep. The tears streamed down, they went to his blessed beard. And after Ja'far finishes, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam acknowledges what he had done. He said to him, "O Ja'far, do you know what just took place right now? While we were gathered here, the angels were present with us. And while we were crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they were crying as well, but rather they were crying more than we were crying. And O Ja'far, let me add to this by telling you that at this time Allah has made Jannah, has made the paradise incumbent upon you. And let me add to this that whenever believers gather together for the purpose of crying and causing one another to cry for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the same thing will occur for them." So when we come to these gatherings, it's not just that, okay, I'm coming to the mosque, I'm going to the center, got to put my time in. I'm coming to, inshallah, be in the company of angels. I'm coming, inshallah, to be in the presence of divine mercy being spread. And I'm coming, inshallah, to be able to gain entrance into paradise through my love of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Brothers and sisters, our topic that we are exploring on these evenings is the enlightened journey, the path of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And as you've seen, this journey that we are speaking about is a journey of understanding what were the factors that kept people away from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. What were those lifestyles that kept people away from Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the ideologies, the practices? What were those things that actually, in some cases, turned them against Imam Hussein alayhi salam? Or in other words, what was the jahiliya, the period of ignorance, the lifestyle of ignorance that had returned back into the ummah, that led them to cause the grandson of the Prophet, of their own very own Prophet, to be martyred? And this is a serious discussion, because when we talk about Jahiliyyah, when we talk about the practices and customs and ideologies of Jahiliyyah, it's something that we can talk about as returning in the modern time as well. Yesterday, we heard the story of Ahnaf. Today, I want to begin with the story of someone who is maybe a little bit more well-known to us in our studies of Islamic history. But sometimes we don't get a chance to see what happened to him. And really, this discussion of what happened to him is something that is very much concerning to all of us. Here I am. Alhamdulillah, Allah has blessed me with the opportunity, with whatever sacrifices I've taken, to be able to attend a majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. In speaking with the community members before, after the program, I see so much love and sincerity and devotion. Allah has blessed you by giving you this opportunity. But the question that we should be asking ourselves, I feel, in these type of gatherings, it's an opportunity, is that, well, this is where I was now, but what happened in the future? The person I would like to speak about for a bit on this evening is somebody by the name of Usama ibn Zayd. Usama is somebody you probably are familiar with from Islamic history. You know that Zayd ibn Thabit was the adopted son of the Prophet. Of course, you know, in Islam, there's no place for adoption in the sense of somebody becoming like a full family member. But there is the tradition of taking care of orphans. And in the case of Zayd, he had a special relationship with our Prophet. He lived with the Prophet. And our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam used to have a lot of love for him, and he would praise him openly. Now, he had a son by the name of Usama. And maybe because Zayd was special to the Prophet, his son Usama was also special to the Prophet. We're told, for example, that Zayd was just a child, maybe 8 years old, after the Battle of Badr, when our Prophet wanted to go and visit and make an official, you know, visit. He put Zayd on his own saddle and he rode with him. And this is a mark of honor. It's a mark of respect. And later we see that Zayd is somebody who is, even though he's young, he shows military prowess. He's able to fight battles of men despite being just a young man at that time. And we know that in the last days of our beloved Prophet's life in this world, one of the concerns that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam had was regarding the succession. He wanted to solidify the position of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam as the wali, as the one who is in charge. One of the ways he did so was to command the Muslims to leave the city and to engage in battle with the Romans. And the army he ordered should be under the leadership of Usama ibn Zayd. Usama at that time was approximately 18 years old. Now imagine that, for example, in a gathering of hundreds or thousands of men, an 18-year-old is chosen to be the leader. Even right now, we would think to ourselves that, well, isn't that person a little bit inexperienced, right? Maybe we we need to go with somebody who's a little bit like, you know, a veteran, right, has seen different things. One of the reasons why our Prophet ﷺ did that is to break some of those customs that had settled in and that had been there actually from the time of Jahiliyyah, and there was a fear of them returning. One of those customs was that by default, de facto, the one who is the older is the one who is more suitable for leadership. There were those who, as the Prophet was getting sick and they saw that now there would be a new leader, they were starting to revive the customs of the Jahiliyyah. And they said that, okay, well, leadership should be in hands of the elder. The Prophet says, no, I am appointing for you a young man. One of the other things the Prophet wants to show is the potential that the youth have. And this is extremely important, that when we look at our youth, sometimes we can see the greenness, right? We can see that, oh, this person is inexperienced, right? We can see how maybe they make mistakes at times. And sometimes, you know, as caregivers, as older brothers, as parents, we can make it a big deal, right? To focus on those areas where they fall short, not realizing the immense potential that they have. And so one of the things our Prophet shows us is that Usama is somebody who is a young man, but he has potential. And we know that according to history, despite the command of the Prophet, despite his getting angry when he realized that the Muslims were not following that command, the army of Usama ibn Zayd never left the city and never was able to really dispatch and go towards the Romans. With all the efforts, they started and they failed. Now anyhow, once our beloved Prophet leaves this world and he departs from this world, Usama ibn Zayd is somebody who is a known figure. He's somebody who has prestige. He was the one who they used to see riding next to the Prophet on his own saddle. He's the one who was appointed as the commander of the army. What he does, what he says, people take note of that. He is one of the elite. But history tells us that when it came time for Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam to become the Khalifa of the Muslims, Usama ibn Zayd refuses to give him the bay'ah. He does not give him allegiance. Now what happened? Right? One of the things that's recorded in history is that Usama, because of his status, the previous khulafa, they used to give him a special handout, a special stipend from the treasury. And so when Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam comes into power, Usama writes him a letter. He says that, you know what kind of person I am. I'm ready to leap into the mouth of a lion to show my bravery and support you. But right now, I'm asking you for some money. And so please, the same way I was used to get money from the treasury, I need that money. What does Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam respond to him? He says to him, just the gist of it is that, Usama, this money is not mine to give. I'm not like the previous khulafa. I'm not going to do things that way. I have some personal funds in Medina. You can have access to those however much you want, but you're not going to get any amount of the treasury. Maybe this is one of the factors that influences him. Anyhow, the time comes for war. We know that with the succession of Imam Ali alayhi salam, civil war took place for the first time among the Muslims. And Imam Ali alayhi salam summons the warrior, the man who was chosen as the commander of the army, somebody who was famous. He says, now it's your time. Right? You're there. It's time for you to come and to participate in this battle. What does Usama do at this point when he's tested? This is very important. He tells him that, I love you. You're very dear to me, O Ali ibn Abi Talib. In fact, you're the most dear of all of creation to me. This is what he says. But I have made a pledge that I will not fight with the people of La ilaha illallah. So therefore, I'm not going to be able to join you in this battle. Now, what is the thinking of Usama ibn Zayd? This is important, and I'm going into these details because we're trying to understand the thought pattern here. Why did he make this statement? It goes back to an incident that took place during his lifetime where he was participating in a battle. He had a spear ready to go, and there was a man who he was charging it from the army of the disbelievers. And that man, when he saw that he was for sure going to be taken down by Usama's spear, he starts to say, La ilaha illallah. So this time, he's ready with the spear. He knows that that man realizes that basically it's over. And he thinks to himself, okay, at this point, he can't be sincere. I have to go ahead with this. And he launches that spear. Our beloved Prophet finds out about this. And he questions Usama ibn Zayd about what he had done. He asks him, oh, Usama, did you kill somebody who professed to the unity of God, somebody who took the shahada of La ilaha illallah? Usama says that he did it, just wanted to save his life. It wasn't something that was real. And what does our Prophet say? Very gently, he wants to teach him. He says, oh, Usama, perhaps you opened up his heart to see the reality of what he was saying. And that's how you came to know this? The Prophet wanted to teach him that this was not the case where he should just make a rash judgment and assume that that person was saying this out of hypocrisy or out of lying. It wasn't his position to actually kill him. Now, what was our Prophet telling him at that time? And what did Usama understand? Our Prophet was telling him that when you do things on the basis of principle. Don't act out of pure emotion. Your responsibility is more than that. I have higher expectations from you, O Usama. But how did he understand this? He understood it to say that the Prophet had made him a specific command for him and him only, that whenever there is a war, if it's a war of Muslims against Muslims, his responsibility is to be quiet and to just sit at home and to be passive and to not cast any judgment on that. It's a position of neutrality. A position of not taking a position. What is the ramifications of doing so? We see that historically, as I mentioned, Usama is somebody who's an important figure. When he doesn't do this, other people take note of it. And they also follow suit. Yesterday we spoke about the Murji'a trend. This is something that is very much alive with the likes of Usama and those who are with him. Beyond that, there's a dangerous precedent being set here, which is that because of one's own personal interpretation, one's own way of reading the world and making sense of it, rather than going back to definitive sources, what's happening is that the definite instructions of the Quran and our Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt are being trampled. What do I mean by this? We're told in the Quran, Allah Ta'ala states very clearly about the responsibilities that we have when it comes to Muslims fighting one another. Allah Ta'ala in Surah Al-Hujarat, in Surah 49, verse number 9, what does he say? He says, وَإِن طَائِفَتَانِ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ اِقْتَتَلُوا. If there are two parties among the believers and they fight with one another, فَأَصْلِحُ. First of all, you go ahead and try to create a truce between them. Make things settle down. فَأَصْلِحُ بَيْنَهُمَا. But what happens if they continue? فَإِنْ بَغَتْ إِحْدَاهُمَا عَلَى الْأُخْرَى. If one of them is unjust and they take action against the other one, then what is the responsibility of the Muslim ummah at that time? فَقَاتِلُوا الَّتِي تَبْغِي حَتَّى تَفِيءَ إِلَىٰ أَمْرِ اللَّهِ. Then you go ahead and you fight with those who continue to follow the path of injustice until they submit. It's very clear here. Allah foresaw, of course, Allah is a book of guidance. In the Quran, He gives instructions of everything. This is what happens when you have civil war as well. And if we see what the efforts that Imam Ali Islam took in his life to prevent war, you see that he gave everything in the way of God to see if he could avoid war. Only when it was absolutely necessary, he said, okay, this is what we need to do. So Usama is setting this dangerous precedent that we're not going to act according to Quranic principles, we're going to act according to our own understanding. Now, if we fast forward now to Usama ibn Zayd, what happens at the end of his life? It's very interesting. Usama fell sick before the Qiyam of, and before the uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. But when he fell sick, he receives a visit from Imam Hussein alayhi salam himself. Why? Because Imam Hussein alayhi salam knows of his qualities. He knows of his precedence. He knows of his position with the Prophet. And he goes to him and he sees that Usama is very sad. He's saying again and again, "Wa ghamma, wa ghamma." I'm really grieved at this time. So Imam Hussein asks him, "What is it that's bothering you?" He says that I have some amount of money that I owed somebody. I wasn't able to pay it back. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam says that, "Don't worry about that. I got it covered. I'm going to take care of you." I just want to make a note here. You know that a lot of times we don't get a chance to talk about Imam Hussein alayhi salam before the events of Karbala. But this is one of them, where we see that he knows this is somebody who was partly responsible for the injustice done to his father. But at this time of need, Imam Hussein alayhi salam steps in and he says that, "I'm going to take care of this for you." Sometimes we're trying to understand what is our responsibility towards our community. This responsibility, the social responsibility of being there for one another at times of need financially, is something which is very important. I know that various communities have different schemes for being able to help people through loans, for education, for starting a business, for, let's say, buying a car or whatever it is. These type of efforts are very commendable. And imagine that somebody says that for the sake of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, I'm going to establish such a thing. Not just, of course, on a personal level, it's one thing, but to make it an institution is even better. These are some of the things that lessons that we can draw from our study of the life of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So brothers and sisters, we have this example of Usama bin Zayd, somebody who took this path of neutrality. Yesterday we spoke about this, but we just introduced this idea that in the modern time we find a similar type of thought pattern. Those who retreat into this position of saying that I have no position. It's what's called postmodernism. I didn't get a chance, however, yesterday to expand upon this and to talk about the practical implications. How does it work then when we interact with others? How does it work when we interact with our families? So inshallah, today is the opportunity for me to explore this. In the modern times, we have this notion that's been understood of plurality. Now, plurality is not always a bad thing. It's a term that can be used in so many different ways. Some uses of it are very genuine and very appropriate. For example, we live in societies where people come from many different backgrounds, many different faith backgrounds, and we're in the same space, we're sharing the same space, we're living in the same society. And in that sense, for somebody to have a pluralistic outlook, I'm using these terms deliberately because we need to understand that sometimes they're used in different ways. For somebody to have a pluralistic outlook where they see themselves as a member of a diverse society is something which is positive. However, pluralism itself at times can be something which is exactly the opposite of ideology. Ideology is where we understand truth and we understand the application of truth because of there being an absolute standard. Sometimes pluralism can run contrary to that. And so in order to explain this, I want to give an example. Yesterday, I quoted to you the ayah of the Quran from Surah Luqman, where Allah describes himself as being al-haq, being the truth. Now, if you want to make a picture of this, imagine that we have somebody who is thirsty, and that somebody who's thirsty is searching for some water to drink. There are some who say that truth itself is relative. There is no absolute standard for truth. Anybody who thinks that they have access to the truth, they are like somebody who's thirsty. They think that there's a lake somewhere out there, and they think that there's a way to get to that lake. But in reality, what's out there is not a lake, it's a mirage. There is no such thing like a lake. The only thing we can tell you is that there are no lakes. All the lakes are mirages. That is the example of absolute relativity, relativity of truth. And that is a type of thought, if you go to the universities, if you go to humanities, right? It is, if you go to architecture, it's quite amazing. Sometimes you see structures being put up that reflect this type of thought pattern. Thoughts and ideologies can actually have a huge impact on the way a society is formed, including construction. I'll just make a side point here. Traditionally, the construction of Islamic centers and mosques was done in a way where it blended humbly into the surrounding environment. Even the roofs, if you go and study, they were made in a way that they wouldn't protrude boldly into the sky. They would fade in. Why? Because everything has a position in front of God, including the buildings that we build. But postmodern architecture is something which is completely different. You go and it's just, I don't know what word you say about it. Maybe you say bizarre. Right? There's no rhyme or reason to why they do what they do. So this is one ideology, the relativity of truth. Now here, as I said, you might think that you have access to the truth, but whether you're a Jew or a Christian or a Buddhist or you have belief in a naturalist or a pagan religion, all of that is just a mirage. Right? You can go chasing it in your life if you want, but at the end of the day, you're going to realize that all your efforts were futile. Now you can imagine what the implications of this ideology are. And sometimes we see that, unfortunately, even among our youth. Which is that when I'm taught, when there's an entire education system that's predicated on this, then I end up starting to believe that everything, all efforts are absolutely futile. It's just I'm chasing a mirage. Well, what's the point of living then? Right? I don't have anything to work towards. Right? This is something which is quite dangerous. There's another level of pluralism which is called not the relativity of truth. It's called the relativity of knowledge. Now, this is a little bit better, a little bit more acceptable to us, but not completely, because there's something that's also dangerous about this. Right? And of course, I'm working my way towards the Islamic understanding, and then I'm going to talk about the practical implications. The understanding of relativity of knowledge is what? That you think that you have access to the truth. You actually do have a right to say that there is truth out there. What you imagine to be truth is actually water. But in reality, there is no way for you to get to that water. So whether you're a Muslim or whether you are, again, Christian, Jew, whatever it is, right? There is an absolute truth out there, but that absolute truth is so great and so vast and so mysterious, no matter what you do, you're not going to be able to get there. It's not a mirage, but it's just a lake that you can't access. So what happens now? The net effect is that it's the same thing, because all the efforts that you put in, it's going to be futile. Just don't try. All right? That, of course, is something which is not acceptable to the people of faith. What is the third level of pluralism? And this is very important. The third level is something which is called the relativity of understanding. Now, what is this analogy? This analogy is one where I believe that there is truth out there. That truth is like a water, like lake. There is a lake out there. You can access that lake. You can get there. You can reach there. You can reach there through the path of Islam, and you might be able to reach there through other paths as well. However, there's an important caveat. Once you get there, how much of that water you're going to be able to take depends on a few factors. Number one is how much thirst you have. Right? People who aren't thirsty, when they get to that water, they're not going to be able to take from it. Right? I'm thirsty, I'm full, I can't drink any more water. Secondly, is what is your container by which you're going to be able to take this water? How much are you going to be able to take? Because let's say you get to the water and you have a tiny water bottle, and that water bottle itself has a hole in it. Well, whatever you're going to be able to get in that water bottle, it's going to be very limited. It's not saying that you have no access to the truth. It's questioning you and saying that how are you going to be able to position yourself to be able to get to the most water possible. How can you position yourself so that you're as thirsty as possible? So then when you get to that water, you're going to have some relief. So do you see here, brothers and sisters, with this analogy, it can help us to understand what our position should be in the society that we're in. Some will say that just take a position of neutrality, right? Just take this position that, look at different strokes for different folks, right? Your truth is your truth, my truth is my truth, and that's the way things are going to be. We live in a post-truth world. Sometimes you hear this expression. There's no point in trying to find the truth anymore. It's too difficult. It's too hard. We can put those aside and we can say that we have a more sophisticated understanding. We know, all of us, those who are sincere, those who are sincere in their faith, they might have some way of accessing that truth. It's possible. They're making their way towards that lake. Sometimes they might go this way or that way, but eventually they might get there. But what can we do to equip them so that when they get there, they have the best tools to access it? Maulana Rumi, the famous poet, he has a beautiful story that he gives. He says that one time, and you know, usually his stories are based on hadith or based on the ayat of the Quran. He says that one time there was one of the prophets of God who met a shepherd. And the shepherd was limited in his understanding of the world around him. And he found it very curious to hear what the shepherd was saying. The shepherd was saying that he was crying out. He's saying, "Oh my God, where are you? Oh my God, show yourself to me so that I can do what?" He says, "That so I can come and I can clean your little home." Show yourself to me so I can come and kiss your little hand. That's a bit strange. Come to me and show yourself to me so that I can serve you and I can mend your buttons when they come undone. Right? Come to me so that I can cook some food for you, and these types of things. Now you can understand here that from the shepherd's perspective, right, his understanding was very limited. His understanding of God was something where God was just like maybe a master, and he wants to be a servant of like a human being who is worthy of being served. Na'udhu billah. But this was his understanding. He tells him, this prophet hears him say that, "Oh God, show yourself to me. Don't you know that I want to sacrifice all my sheep for you? I want to sacrifice all my goats for you. When I call to my goats, and I say, oh, and I say, e, and I say, I, all these are ways of remembering you." Right? So at this point, the prophet steps in and he says that, "Tell me, who are you talking to? What are these words that you're saying?" And the shepherd says that, "I'm talking to the one who created the very earth that we live on and the very skies that are raised in the sky." So he says, "Leave aside this nonsense that you're saying. What is this about God having a hand and this thing and that thing?" And Maulana Rumi goes on to say that later on, the prophet receives revelation from God. And God asks him, he says that, "What are you doing? What is it that you did with that man? Why is it that you spoke to him this way? I tasked you with the job of bringing together, but your action right here has been a source of separation. What might be honey for you at this point is poison for him. What might be poison for you is honey for him. But I will accept what he is doing right now." So the prophet gets the message. He goes back to the man. They reconcile. And if this was the end of the story, we might say that, okay, well, maybe, you know, this, we don't have a proper understanding of it. Because after all, we do know that the prophet was more educated. We know that that man was ignorant. He was making mistakes. But the story goes on. Maulana Rumi says that that man thanked him for bringing him to a higher level of understanding. His tool set has now increased. His water bottle has gotten bigger. When he goes to that water now, he's going to be able to take more from it. And he's on a journey that maybe at one point he will go to that prophet and say that, "You teach me. Teach me about God. And then teach me how to talk to God. And then teach me how to pray to God. Because whatever I've done with my own understanding has been limited. So he thanked the Prophet for allowing him to reach a higher level of understanding. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So brothers and sisters, when it comes to our position in the society, our interaction with those of the same faith, those with other faiths, when we look at it from this perspective, somebody who says that religion is something which is a personal choice, it's up to everyone, whatever they want to do, I'm not going to have anything to say about what anyone else does, that is might be a convenient position, but it's not a position which is in line with the teachings of our faith. Our faith teaches us that we do have access to that truth. And we do have the tools to be able to get that truth and acquire it for ourselves. And when we look at others who have another set of tools, we can say with confidence that because we have access to the last message, we have the most sophisticated set of tools. But that does not give us a right to be arrogant over others. Because who knows, maybe that set of tools that has been offered to me, I haven't taken full advantage of it. And I've been presented with that hujjah, that proof from God, but God hasn't presented that other person with that hujjah. That's why Allah Ta'ala says in the Quran, وَمَا كُنَّا مُعَذِّبِينَ حَتَّى نَبْعَثَ رَسُولًا Surah Al-Isra. That we are not going to punish somebody until we send them the message and the messenger. If somebody didn't get access to that tool set, then they're going to have a valid excuse. So this is important. That when I'm dealing with others, I look and see, what is the reason for this person not being guided? What is this reason for this person having a set of different values, different morals? Is it out of deliberate injustice? Or is it out of an excusable ignorance? If it's out of excusable ignorance, then I need to take a different path. It's very interesting. You know, we have one of the very strong commandments in our faith is the teaching of Amr ibn Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar. Amr ibn Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar, commanding to the good and forbidding evil, it applies even when it comes to our interaction with non-Muslims. This is something that often we're not aware of. Even when it comes to our interaction with non-Muslims. Why? Because everyone has the responsibility of being a servant of Allah. But the approach that I take will be different depending on whom I'm talking to, how much of an excuse they have with respect to that ignorance. Even those who don't have an excuse, my approach has to be very sophisticated. I have to take a right approach in order for me to have an effect. But when it comes to my position in the society, on one hand, I have to be firm on my understanding that I do have an ideology. There is the truth. On the other hand, I have to be able to be flexible in the sense that I understand that different people come from different backgrounds. They have different level of understanding. I want to see what I can do to help them. I don't want to be arrogant in the process. One time there was a companion of our sixth Imam, alayhi salam. And he asks him, he says that sometimes we come across people who are from different faiths. Is it okay if we somehow speak badly about them? If we, you know, take an approach which is not the akhlaqi approach? And the Imam alayhi salam says that no. He says, haven't you heard the story of the magicians of Fir'aun? Who were the magicians of Fir'aun? They were people who were the arch enemies of the Prophet. But in the matter of less than an hour, when that proof was presented to them, now they have access to a bigger container for being able to access that truth. They have access to the latest and greatest tool set. When they see Nabi Musa alayhi salam perform his miracle, they realize that they had been in a state of ignorance. Now they became shuhada. They became martyrs in the path of God. So this is the example that we have when we're dealing with others. It's not a position of neutrality. It's a position of actively working to try to, first of all, be an example of myself. Second of all, see what I can do to perform my responsibility of calling people to the truth. Our maraji, when people have asked them, they tell us, what is our responsibility when it comes to calling people of other faiths to our faith? Or let's say within Islam, let's say that we have an opportunity to introduce the beautiful teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, their akhlaq, their way of approaching things, their ideology, to those who don't have access to it. Is that our responsibility? Our maraji respond and they say that that in fact is one of the most excellent examples of doing Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy anil Munkar. When you have that opportunity, you take it. But it has to be in a principled way, not in the position of, let's say, you know, I'm neutral in everything. I'm going to be dealing with my religion like something that's in my pocket. I take it out when I want to and I put it back when I'm with others. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The discussion about how we can apply this within the family, inshallah, we will put that on another night when we're talking about family in general and relating it to the jahiliyyah of the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the jahiliyyah of the modern era. Tonight, I want to move now to the masaib portion. We have a very beautiful story that's narrated by one of our greatest scholars by the name of Sayyid ibn Tawus. Sayyid ibn Tawus is the one who, for example, he wrote Iqbal al-A'mal, that is the main source for Mafatih al-Jinan, which we use all the time, and many other contributions. He says very interesting that one of the stories he narrates from a source which he finds trustworthy by the same of Ali ibn Muhammad. He says Ali ibn Muhammad was somebody who used to go for ziyarah of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala. He used to go every month. And tonight is the night where we're going to mention Karbala, so I thought this would be an appropriate story. Every month he would make his way to do the ziyarah of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala. And it seemed that he lived in a city which was somewhat relatively far away. But every month he made a point to do so. Until he reached an elderly age where now it was difficult for him. He wanted to go, but he couldn't go. Finally, after a period of sickness, he said that, okay, now it's been enough time. Even though I'm weak, my body has gotten old, I still want to go. And so he puts that effort in. He makes his way to Karbala. He goes to the dhari of the Imam alayhi salam. He does his ziyarah. He recites the two raka'as. And he's so exhausted from the journey that right there on the spot, he falls asleep. Sayyidina Tawus, rahmatullahi alayhi, he says that in his dream, this man named Ali ibn Muhammad, Ali sees that Imam Hussein alayhi salam emerges from his own grave and he comes to him. And he greets him. He says that, Ya Ali, lima jafawtani? O Ali, why is it that you have done jafa to me? Why is it that you have cut off your relationships from me? You used to be somebody who is very pure towards us. Now Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, they know of our condition. And they know of our state. They know that living in these lands which are far away, it's very difficult. Sometimes even if somebody can go once in a lifetime, that itself is a great accomplishment. But at the same time, they want to demonstrate their compassion to those who are truly their followers and their lovers. And so we can tell from the context of the story that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was not rebuking him for not coming. He knew of his position. But rather, he was showing him the amount of love and affection he had for him on account of his visiting him. So, Ali ibn Muhammad, he responds to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He says that, I'm so sorry, you know, I became old and I was sick, but I'm here right now. And at this point, I want to take advantage of this opportunity. I'm speaking with Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I want to ask you a question. Oh my master, is it true that you have said the following? Man zarani fi hayatihi azuruhu fi mamatihi? That whoever visits me when he's alive, I will visit him when he is dead. Is that true? And the Imam alayhi salam tells him in his dream, Naam, yes, it's true. So he tells him, can I narrate this to other people that whoever visits me in their lifetime, I will visit them in when they leave this world? He says, yes, go ahead and tell them as well. And let me add something to that as well. Imam Hussein tells him that whoever visits me in their lifetime, I will visit them when they die. And if need be, I will pull them out from the nar. I will take them out from the fire of hell. And brothers and sisters, when we come to these gatherings, sometimes we look at our situation, our state of our soul, and we say that I'm feeling so lost. I don't know where to go. I'm running away from so many different things, but they're chasing me. Do I have any hope? Is there any way out of my predicaments? The answer is yes, there is hope. There is a way out. Those tears that you shed for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, each one of them are so valuable. Sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdillah. Sallallahu alayka ya Ibn Rasulillah. Peace and blessings be upon you, O noble soul, O tranquil soul. O the one who is buried in Karbala, along with his sincere companions. O Allah, we ask you to grant us the opportunity to be among the Zuwar, among the visitors of Imam Hussein. O Allah, we want this action of visiting Imam Hussein alayhi salam to be at the forefront of our deeds. When we go to the hereafter, we may not have much to offer, but inshallah we can be accounted among his visitors, and that will be the source of our salvation. Peace be upon you, O Imam Hussein. It was the second of the month of Muharram where Hur received the command from Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad that wherever Imam Hussein alayhi salam might be, don't let him go forward. Don't let him go to Kufa, but rather find some area where it's a desert, where there is no water. Let it be a harsh place where he will find it difficult to settle down. When they are journeying, suddenly Imam Hussein alayhi salam asks, what is the name of this place? They tell him, it's called Nainawa. He asks, is there any other name for it? They tell him that yes, it is called Karbala. Imam Hussein alayhi salam cries out, Allahumma inni a'udhu bika min karbin wa bala. O Allah, I seek refuge in you from difficulties, from calamities and trials. Which trial is Imam Hussein alayhi salam envisioning now? Is it the trial of the thirst of the children? Is it the trial that his son Ali Akbar alayhi salam will face? Is it the trial of the arrow piercing the throat of the baby? Imam Hussein alayhi salam cries out, Hahuna mahallu rikabina wa safku dima'ina wa mahallu quburina. This is the place where our blood will be spilled. This is the place where we will be buried. Imam Hussein alayhi salam is accompanied with those who will be buried with him. But there will be those who are not buried with him. They will have to continue. They will have to go from Karbala onwards. What is Zainab alayhi salam thinking right now when she hears Imam Hussein crying out these words? We're told that the ladies were given hands. They were helped to come down from their mounts, from their horses and camels. But there will come a time where they are mounted as prisoners.
There will be no Abbas to help them to alight. They will be treated roughly and harshly. There will be no Hussein with them when they leave Karbala. ألا لعنة الله على القوم الظالمين وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون.
ماتم يا حسين. يا حسين.